I was especially pleased when Lee and Laurent chose the theme of this PI day to be quantum gravity, having just written a paper about quantum gravity, which to me anyway was very surprising. And what I'm going to tell you about is that in some ways quantum gravity is easier than we expected. And there are some results which are exact and actually rather close to the real world. So the theme of my current research is simplicity. I feel the whole field of theoretical physics over the last 30 years has grown too complex and full of arbitrary assumptions and models which are, let's say, not the most beautiful. We're part of a subject which includes the most beautiful theories and constructions in science, from Maxwell's equations to Einstein's theory of gravity, Dirac's equation. And I think it's our job to find similarly compelling, beautiful explanations of the world. And so that is the theme of my own research. It's not easy to find simple and beautiful things, but I want to encourage everybody to do that and not to get lost in a forest of paraphernalia, which much of modern theory is. Of course, the great advantage physicists have is we get to cheat compared to mathematicians. You know, mathematicians just pursue logic. We get to look at the answer. And that's a very profound and helpful guide as to what the right theoretical approach should be. In the case of cosmology, so here's a rather beautiful picture of the universe on a logarithmic scale from the solar system right back to the Big Bang, which is the singularity, which is the edge of this picture. And observations over the last 10 or 20 years have shown us that the universe is absolutely remarkably simple. In fact, you can argue that the entire universe is the simplest thing we know. It's simpler than a hydrogen atom. Because to describe it, I only need 5 numbers to describe the age, composition, and geometry of the universe. 2 of those numbers describe the pattern of density variations, which in many ways could not be any simpler. So almost perfect scale invariance. That's why I need 2, because not quite scale invariant. It would be 1 if it was perfect scale invariant, but there's a number specifying the amplitude of the fluctuations. The fluctuations are nearly Gaussian. They seem to be scalar, in other words, just density variations, no gravitational waves. So the universe has this incredibly simple geometry on large scales. And it seems to me that's a very profound clue, that whatever theory explains this is going to be very profound and very simple. That's what I'm looking for. So I'm going to talk about quantum gravity and using quantum gravity to describe the Big Bang singularity, because after all, everything here came out of a singularity, which is deeply paradoxical in classical GR. It's literally a point. Everything we know came out of that point where classical GR simply fails completely. And so the question is, can we say anything sensible about the Big Bang singularity in quantum gravity? And I'm going to show you, rather surprisingly, that under some simple and plausible assumptions, in fact, we can solve quantum gravity exactly. Okay. So this is the essential idea in quantum gravity, that you have a 3 universe called U. That means some 3 geometry with matter on it and momenta on it. And then and we have some, just some matter distribution on this 3 geometry. We want to understand how that 3 geometry propagates into another 3 geometry with a different shape and size and matter distribution on it. So there should be some amplitude for one 3 geometry going to another. And the picture is that we're going to integrate over all possible four geometries that connect those three geometries. So that's the basic idea. It's very beautiful. There were some wonderful papers written in the 1960s on this subject. One of them is by Bryce DeWitt, and it includes this beautiful statement. So these are rather technical papers, but this is a sort of philosophical statement. The most impressive fact which emerges is that quantum gravity is an extraordinarily economical theory. It gives one just exactly what is needed to analyze a particular situation, not a bit more. I mean, that's a statement of simplicity. We'll say nothing about time unless a clock is provided, say nothing about geometry until a device is introduced to tell when and where the geometry is to be measured. I'm going to be introducing radiation to do that. And in view of the strongly operational foundations, this is to be expected. When the two theories, quantum theory and gravity, are united, the result is an operational theory par excellence. And so that's the framework we're working in, and this comes up all the time. When you work on this, you can calculate some formula, then you have to figure out what does it mean. And literally the meaning of the formula should come out of the formula without extra assumptions. Now, for some reason, this is a totally obvious thing to do, but this is, for some reason, hadn't been done until our work, as far as I know, to consider the special properties of matter which is conformally invariant in cosmology. Okay, so of course, a lot of people are interested in conformal invariance, but people had not considered the problem of coupling conformally invariant matter to a real dynamical metric, okay, with no boundaries. It's not ADS. This is the whole of space-time being dynamical. And let's couple dynamical three geometry to conformal matter. So theories which are conformally invariant are special in that they are in the UV, conformally invariant in the UV, so the there's a fixed point in the UV. These are special in that they are UV complete. These are theories without an ultraviolet cutoff or a lattice or any other ugly means needed to define the theory. They seem to be UV complete. They're also very special in quantum cosmology. As I will show you, if we take such a theory and truncate the theory just to Friedman-Robertson-Walker symmetry, which is homogeneity and isotropy in space, then actually we can do the path integral for quantum gravity, for at least for the simplest forms of conformal matter, pure radiation, a number of free conformally coupled scalar fields. One could do the same for Dirac fermions or Maxwell theory. The path integral can be performed exactly. So this seems to have been a surprise when I've explained this to experts in quantum cosmology. As far as I can tell, nobody had noticed this point. And furthermore, this solution unambiguously describes a perfect bounce. We call it perfect because what really drives this will be a perfect fluid. This is the simplest form of conformally invariant matter. It's just a normal fluid with pressure equal to 1/3 rho in four dimensions, or more generally, with a stress tensor which is traceless. So if you take this fluid, you can treat it quantum mechanically and do the path integral of these fields with, so here's the pure radiation plus other conformal matter, and this is what it describes, a bounce, that the Big Bang singularity is actually not singular within this quantum mechanical description. Furthermore, we can follow generic metrics. You may say FRW is extreme truncation, though it's very justified by the real world. The real world is FRW to an accuracy of 1 part in 100,000. Seems like a pretty good starting point to describe that. But we would like to put in generic metric and matter perturbations. And what we've shown is you can follow them across the singularity between the collapse and the expansion with no particle production as long as the theory is exactly conformal. The matter is exactly conformal. Simplest case. So this is quite easy to see why this works, classically. Take a Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric. So homogeneity and isotropy of space fixes space to be either have the geometry of a three-hyperboloid Euclidean space or a three-sphere. Here's the Ricci scalar of the spatial metric. And then the Friedman equation comes down to this. In conformal time, and with A, the scale factor of the universe, or the conformal factor of the metric. So here's the Friedman equation. It's pretty obvious to see what happens. As A goes to zero, which is the Big Bang singularity, the curvature term is irrelevant. A dot is plus or minus one. So A is proportional to T, the time. And the metric is just T squared times a constant metric. Well, there's your bounce. Because when T is negative, this is absolutely fine. It's a positive coefficient. When T is positive, it's positive. When T equals zero, the metric degenerates for one instant. But notice that it's absolutely analytic in T. And that's what we call a perfect bounce. It has a unique analytic extension from negative to positive scale factor. So the picture is going to be that the scale factor will change sign from being negative initially. A is going like T, so the size of the universe is collapsing. A squared is positive, of course. It goes through the singularity, comes out the other side expanding. And turns out when you study linear perturbations, and that this was the clue that suggested the treatment I'm going to describe, when you study linear perturbations around these background, all the perturbations, the density perturbations, the gravitational waves, you discover they have beautiful analytic properties. So even though linear perturbation theory fails at T equals zero, you can analytically continue the perturbations around T equals zero in an absolutely unique manner. There are no branch cuts or other ambiguities. Let's complicate the story a little bit by adding a number of scalar fields. So this is supposed to be additional matter. It's interesting to do, partly because one can do it, and partly because, of course, the Higgs field is a natural scalar field we know exists. And it's interesting to ask how can you include scalar fields into this picture. So if we introduce M scalar fields, conformally coupled, here they are. This is chi, this minus is the conventional sign for the kinetic term. I'm in signature minus plus plus plus. So these have positive kinetic energy. They have conformal coupling. And for simplicity, give them no other potential. So just free conformally coupled scalar fields. We can introduce another scalar field called phi, which is just a gauge degree of freedom. Okay, so you can introduce the scalar field phi. Once you've done so, the entire action, including gravity, is conformally invariant under Weyl transformations of phi, chi, and the metric. And here's the radiation fluid, the perfect radiation fluid. Having done that, so this is called a lift. You introduce a fictitious field phi in order to enlarge the field space and enlarge the symmetry to Weyl symmetry. And then within that bigger theory, you have more freedom to choose a gauge. And it's sort of clearer how to treat the theory. If you tried to do what I was doing in Einstein frame from the start, it would be possible, but much more messy. So we can pick a Weyl gauge in which the three metric is static. In other words, that A of T factor is one. And in that case, all the dynamics will be in these field phi and chi. All the Friedman-Robertson-Walker dynamics will be in these two fields. One of them has the wrong sign kinetic term. That represents the scale factor of the universe. And the other ones have the right sign. In this gauge, the solution for the radiation density is just that it's constant. So in this Weyl gauge, The universe is neither expanding nor contracting, the metric. Everything is in phi and chi. And secondly, the radiation doesn't redshift or blueshift because the 3 metric is not changing. Now we'll define new coordinates on field space called x. Yes?
My job to hold the clock time.
To time? Yes. Warning. Okay. I'll have to speed up substantially. I'll skip a few slides. So, clever change of coordinates. You can rewrite the action like this. It's a bunch of harmonic oscillators, one of which has the wrong sign kinetic term. There's a Hamiltonian. One can do a gauge fixing, blah, blah, blah. The path integrals are Gaussian. You're left with one ordinary integral, which is not Gaussian. And here's the exact propagator for FRW universes. Not an obvious formula, but wonderful thing about it is the path integral itself defines the contour it is to, with a classical solution. So path integral has, generically, you will find one or more saddle points to the action, which are the classical solutions. Each saddle point defines a class of contours of integration in the path integral by steepest descent. So I sit in the saddle point, I go a little bit away from it, I flow in such a direction so that the integral converges. And in that way, I find the steepest descent contour. And of course, it will give, there's an infinite class of contours that will give the same result, but it tells you what contour of integration to take. And so in these different cases of negatively curved or positively curved universes, there are different integration paths for tau, but the integral, the path integral itself tells you which path to take. This is enough to define the vacuum of the theory. It defines the vacuum state of the theory. So every classical solution defines its own vacuum state. It's rather a beautiful thing. We've extended this to generic metrics. First of all, anisotropic metrics. These are metrics in which the scale factor is different in the different dimensions. I'll cut to the chase of this. There's a rather surprising thing, okay? So anisotropy is a very violent phenomenon. As you go, if the universe is expanding slightly differently in one direction compared to the other two, this difference will blow up as you go back to the singularity. So some dimensions will actually expand, and the others will shrink violently to zero. It turns out all of that is described by an inverse square potential in the relevant Schrodinger-like equation. It's very like quantum mechanics in an inverse square potential for a very simple reason. There's no scale in this equation, right? The kinetic and potential terms scale in the same way. And when you have anisotropy, you haven't introduced any scale, and that's why you get this Schrodinger equation. What has, as far as I know, not been noticed about this inverse square potential is its very special property. It's invisible. Okay? So, if I throw a ball against a wall, it comes back after a certain time. Now introduce an inverse square potential between me and the wall. Repulsive. Okay? Throw the ball again. It'll come back at exactly the same time. Okay? You could be hiding beneath the potential. I don't know if this has ever been used for any stealth technology, but it could be. You see, the ball slows down as it's traveling towards the wall, but it bounces sooner. So the time delay due to slowing down and the time advance due to bouncing sooner, cancel exactly. And so inverse square potential is invisible, classically. Quantum mechanically, there is a unique propagation rule which respects this behavior, and therefore, and the correspondence principle. You'd like your quantum theory as far as possible to respect the properties of a classical theory, at least for highly excited states. So it's very interesting that the proposal we use does that. All the other proposals I know of do not. So various people like Maldacena, have proposed that you have to set the wave function of the universe to zero at the singularities by hand. I mean, they'd literally stop the universe from you know, being traced back before the singularity. The no boundary proposal does it again in a different way, by rounding off the geometry. If you don't do that and just follow what the equations are telling you and obey the correspondence principle, there is a unique prescription which respects this behavior, that there is, that the potential is invisible. And furthermore, these other proposals have lots of undesirable features. They lead to a real wave function which has zero norm. There is a conserved norm called the DeWitt norm. It's actually zero if your wave function is real. Furthermore, they can't even describe an expanding universe. To describe an expanding universe, you need a complex wave function. If you impose a boundary condition at A equals zero, you get a real wave function, and that's just unable to describe expansion. So these other proposals are pretty problematic. There is a way of dealing with all this, which seems to be totally natural and very close to the classical solutions. And what it amounts to is you take the positive frequency modes and you evolve, positive frequency modes and propagate them in the lower half complex plane around the singularity at A equals zero. You do the opposite for the negative frequency modes. It's as simple as that. There's a general prescription that the wave function would be, you know, the wonderful thing about this path integral or the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is a wave it's linear. The quantum mechanics is linear in the wave function. That includes all the nonlinear dynamics of GR. So it's totally natural to split this wave function into two pieces which propagate around the singularity in this way. We've done generic perturbations. What we find is that as long as conformal symmetry holds, then the incoming vacuum is the outgoing vacuum. Here's the bounce. If there are violations of conformal symmetry involving lower energy scales, this means that the particle production is finite across the singularity. So that's pretty nice. Yep.
We've got 5 minutes for the whole discussion.
Okay. All right, here's the movie. Okay. And, you know, basically what's going on is that because the matter is conformally symmetric, it doesn't really know that the universe is going to a singularity. And you can follow the equations perfectly fine near the singularity, and they go through. So I was going to tell you about another topic, but I think I'm just going to show you the movie. This is work with Whaley Penn, which actually arose from this other work because we studied high-order perturbation theory, and we discovered that cosmological perturbation theory was actually more interesting than had been previously thought.
So those relations are what, at least, so what are you showing us? Can you say it?
I can say it. This is the simplest form of matter.
So this is just radiation?
Pure radiation.
So what are the assumptions that go in?
Scale invariant spectrum of initial...
Right?
So perfect radiation, yeah, with scale invariant standard adiabatic modes,
okay,
scale invariant power spectrum. Okay, that's it. Gaussian
and
noise.
Then you let it evolve.
Yes. Okay, so this wasn't realized before. What happens is if the amplitude is epsilon, and in the real universe, epsilon was about 10 to the minus 4, then after 1 over epsilon, oscillation periods of the waves, they form shocks.
And this happens, so what time scale is the universe? Sorry.
This description is valid, and it would take me a while to explain why,
yeah,
but it's valid for temperatures between 10 to the 7 GeV and 1 GeV.
10 to the 7 GeV and 1 GeV.
Yes. Below 1 GeV, the neutrino streaming wipes out the shocks before that, sort of before they form. Above 10 to the 7 GeV is another dissipative effect. I'll have to think about what it is. But essentially, they start forming at 10 to the 7 GeV, and at 1 GeV, they cease. So it's quite a good span of energy that you would have these shocks. They'll make gravitational waves. It just so happens that the wavelength they generate waves on is roughly the wavelength of the LIGO experiment. And so if the amplitude of these perturbations was larger than the than what we see today on our horizon, we would actually see them at the LIGO.
So
we haven't got a precise number, but my guess is about 100 times larger than what we see today. Then they would be seen at LIGO. So we can set bounds on the amplitude of the adiabatic perturbations between at very small scale. Okay, so we can already set limits on the universe before 1/1,000,000th of a second using LIGO. Okay, it's kind of interesting. And ultimately we'll see this. Thanks to people like you, I'm convinced we're going to see this. We will see the gravitational waves made by these shocks.
Okay, I'm going to ask, so how much more do you need to do for sensitivity?
We need precise numbers. I can't give you them yet. Yeah, we're still calculating them. Okay, so that is it.
Einstein said that any fool can make things more complicated, but it's a genius to make things simpler.
Right. Right.
So you mentioned operationalism at the beginning, but where does it come out?
It comes in throughout. So you work out some formula like this propagator between one scale factor and another, A and A prime. And you think, well, what do I do with this? One thing you can do is try to work out the sort of expectation value of the expansion or contraction rate with this wave function. Okay. To do that, you need to use the DeWitt norm, which DeWitt introduced, but it's not the usual psi star psi, because this is a relativistic system. And you know, psi squared is only conserved if there's a non-relativistic equation, Schrodinger equation. So you have to start from an equation that looks like the Klein-Gordon equation and use this other norm. Then there's been a long-standing puzzle is that that norm is not positive, not obviously positive and not necessarily positive. It turns out there's a totally natural resolution of that problem, which is that the background universe has a big mass, M. And this is just like if you do the Klein-Gordon equation for a very massive particle, you can approximate the wave function as e to the minus imt times chi of t and x. And then you find this chi satisfies a non-relativistic Schrodinger equation. And so that's exactly what happens here, is that this mass is proportional to the volume, the co-moving volume, in other words, how much radiation you've got in the universe. This becomes large, and all the matter fields become described by a non-relativistic Schrodinger equation in that background.
With an
absolutely conserved norm, exactly. So basically, if psi is this, then the DeWitt norm is this, dt psi, and this becomes approximately 2 m mod chi squared, and that's the normal Schrodinger norm. Okay, so you will reproduce the results of field theory in a background. Okay, so all I'm saying is that in principle everything is there, it defines itself. I mean, this issue about the choice of contours for tau, I was quite puzzled about just a month ago. But it turns out, and this seems to be not widely known, even in ordinary quantum field theory, which, let's say, a massive scalar field. You know, one approach is you start from quantized fields. Another approach is to say, no, start from a quantized particle, relativistic particle. Then it turns out there's this tau integral, just the same. It's called Schringer proper time representation. Normally, people just prescribe the contour, and they put an I epsilon to make things converge. That is completely unnecessary. If you take the path integral as it is, and you insist it converges, you find a classical solution, and you do steepest flow definition of the contour, it is defined for you. That was a bit of a revelation to me, and it seems to work in our context too.
Okay. One or two more comments, John?
Behind me. Okay, so John, then Basu, and then Milan. My way of teaching Max's equations are the trace of T meter zero.
Right.
No massive parts.
Exactly.
So what do you mean by conformal mass?
Sorry? Conformal mass.
Conformal mass.
Oh, conformal matter is conformally invariant. So Maxwell is the archetype.
So what about
scalar fields with conformal coupling are conformal, the Dirac field is conformal, as long as there's no mass, explicit mass.
So these are massless particles?
These are all massless particles.
What about particles which have mass?
Right, so the scenario would be that the fundamental laws of physics will not have a scale, will be conformal. So near the singularity, things should be totally scale-free. And that's how the singularity is resolved. But as the temperature falls and coupling constants run away from UV fixed points, high-energy fixed points, the mass scales appear.
So break conformal here.
Yes. I mean, this you would want to... I mean, ideally, we would like to have laws where we spontaneously break conformal invariants. Nobody knows how to do that.
Okay.
There are, but there, you know, that's what we'd like.
That's it. Yeah. So, Professor, does this have anything to say about the so-called BKL oscillations?
Yes, it does. That was briefly mentioned on one of the slides.
Okay.
So it's underappreciated that the discovery of the Higgs boson means there are no BKL oscillations. Okay. You take the standard model with no scalar fields, it has BKL oscillations. Once you have just one scalar field, that's enough to remove them. It's a very simple reason. It's because the kinetic energy of the scalar field goes as 1 over a to the sixth in physical units as you go to a equals zero, which is the same scaling as the anisotropy. And so providing the kinetic energy in the Higgs is big enough to beat the anisotropy kinetic energy, there's no BKL. So, yeah, from a very, very conservative point of view, you could say the physics we know does not predict BKL oscillations.
Okay, quick,
Farah. Just a question, you went fast when you showed me something which is negative
direction.
There.
Right.
Could you go back?
Sure.
And then the trace of contour. So. Usually, when you have such an Hamiltonian, it's treated as a constraint. But in your case, it's really a real Hamiltonian.
This one?
No.
This one?
Before that, just that.
Here?
Yeah.
Here?
And this
here.
The other side.
Yes.
So now you go, it's no longer, you don't treat it as a constraint.
The constraint is implemented by the tau integral.
But the tau is between 1/2 and minus 1/2.
No, that's T. T is the parameter.
Okay, so
tau is the lapse.
So there's
tau is the lapse. Yeah. No,
and when you talk about the contour, you talk about the contour in tau?
In tau. The contour for everything else is obvious because it's Gaussian.
Yeah.
Okay? So there's only one saddle point, and steepest descent will pick one contour, and that's it. So the contour for the sort of functional part of the calculation is trivial. The contour for tau is not trivial. When you do this integral, you get an in the exponent e to the 1 over tau and e and plus tau. So there's a non-Gaussian integral, which you can do exactly. But the way to do this is to do it in two steps. First, you integrate out the fields. And now you're left with an ordinary function of tau. And then you find the steepest descent contour in the complex tau plane. And that given the classical solution for x.
You're saying this is the same as I epsilon?
Yes.
Is that easy to only
no,
zero?
No. No,
so
it's not.
Let's stop it here.
Okay.
Let's thank Neil.
Okay, thank you.